Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show. And I'm so glad to be with you. I have to tell you, I'm still a little bit dizzy from last weekend in Minneapolis. Actually, I was gone for more than a weekend. I left, and this is why I missed you last week. Actually, I've missed you for 3 weeks because I was in Israel, right? And then I was home 2 days. Then I went to Minneapolis to teach at Buffalo Covenant Church a little more than a week ago, and then I went over to our place in northern Wisconsin for a couple days and froze like crazy, 17 degrees. The only thing to keep me warm was our little wood stove in our cabin, but it was nice to rusticate for a few days. Then I drove back for the magnificent Minneapolis opener of Rethink. Unbelievable. Grace Church Eden Prairie holds 4,500 people when you consider the balcony. They closed the balcony, and we just about filled the auditorium. Now, it doesn't mean, let's say, 1,545, that's about 3,000. Yeah. We had about 2,500 students and some change. Amy, do we have a final number on that? But I think it was right around 2,500, maybe a little bit more. 2,500! Can you believe that? Our largest opener for Rethink up until this time ago was like 4 years ago when we opened up Birmingham at 1,600. We were happy with that. And still would be anywhere, 1,600 young people. But there was an incredible ground game over there by Grace Church Eden Prairie, and that city has a lot of Christians in it. And I didn't even do a survey, but I talked to people who came from Fargo, North Dakota, obviously from Minnesota, from Wisconsin, from, St. Louis, Missouri, and somewhere in Canada, Winnipeg. Those are just people who chatted with me. That's five different kind of locations, right? And I'm sure there were a lot more states that were represented there. Usually there's close to 15 for any regional. It was a magnificent launch. And I tip my hat to the Stand to Reason team, the magnificent team that we had on the ground taking care of everything. Kyle and Ocean and Amy and John and Tim and Alan and so many more. Danielle, magnificent. Okay, so good for you guys. And we're just thrilled. Man, it was so great. It was just so great. And they want us back next year, and that means we're going to have a lot more next year. We might have 3,000 next year, because you know what happens. People go, and they're kind of tire kickers. Well, let's see what's happening and see if we like it. And then they go home, and then their whole youth group comes the next year because they're so excited about what they experience at Rethink. So I'm just thanking the Lord and all the people that had significant roles to play in that enterprise. It was wonderful. And something else going on right now. Oh, I should probably tell you. Friday, February 28th, Saturday, February 29th, Greg, Alan, Tim, John, and I don't know who else is, Amy. That's the Stand to Reason contingent, Cottonwood Creek Church in Dallas, Texas, Rethink. Rethink Your False Ideas About God. That's been the series title this year, starting with Orange County, and then with Minneapolis, and then Dallas, and February 28th and 29th, and then April, I think, we'll be in Birmingham with the same topic. Okay, we'll start again next fall with a new one. By the way, on Friday, November 15th, and Saturday the 16th, that's this week, I'll be in Portland, Oregon at the third annual Spotlights on You Apologetics Conference. It'll be at Cedar Mill Bible Church. I'll be teaching on the Columbo Tactic and Ambassadors for Christ, Contending for the Faith, Mary Jo will be there. Because that's where her mom lives. And let's see, who else? Tim will be there with me. All right, that's February 28th and 29th. Rethink Apologetics. Oh, I'm sorry, not that. SpotlightsOnYou.com. And, okay, I'm just making a note here. I have in my hand right now Tactics a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions, 10th anniversary edition. Oh, updated and expanded. It just feels so good. It's heavier. Let's see. The other one, I don't know how many pages. This is 282 pages, counting the notes. Ooh, it's so weighty. Do you know that in this book I doubled the amount of tactics that I teach on? I have a whole chapter of a new tactic that I've used a long time but never wrote on called Inside Out. In fact, this Solid Ground that we just had, that just went out beginning of this month, is a condensed version of that. And that'll give you a little taste. But then there's a whole chapter of many tactics. And there's five more there. So this basically doubles the number of tactics in this new book. You're not going to get anything like this anywhere else but from this book. You know, a lot of authors would like to be able to say that about their books, and I'm glad I can say it about mine. Just turns out to be completely unique, and I had so many people that talked to me when I was there in Minneapolis about how much this book had helped them, and I'm very flattered, I'm very excited, humbled, all those things, okay, but it's cool. I still think it's kind of cool, all right? And incidentally, we would like to send you a copy. December's coming up. That means in our end of year efforts, we got a big goal that we're trying to meet financially for the end of year. We got to finish strong to start next year strong. And once again, we have a dedicated group of challenge supporters that are offering a challenge gift of nearly $250,000 that they've pledged. And of course, the challenge is that you add your support to theirs and help meet or exceed their gift before the end of the year, December 31st. If it's postmarked by the end of the year, then that will be this year's, part of this year's budget income. And boy, they're really setting the standard. Last year it was only $225,000. Now we're pushing $250,000, and they're asking you to step up and accept their challenge and make your best gift before the deadline. And what we're going to do when you respond in the month of December with your gift, we are going to rush to you a signed copy of the revised and expanded Double the Number of Tactics, Tactics Book, 10th Anniversary Edition. And we're going to also give you a bonus, a special code to download our video on tactics in engaging false ideas that Alan and Brett, and rather Alan and Tim and I did for Rethink in Orange County just about a month ago. So same thing we did in Minneapolis and what we're going to be doing in Dallas and Birmingham next year. But we're going to send you that. So there's a bonus along with the book for your gift in December, and giving your best gift that you can in order to meet the challenge of those dedicated faithful partners that have donated and have contributed to the challenge core gift. The Tactics official launch is Tuesday, November 26th. And you can purchase the book if you want to. Get it in advance of your gift, and we're sending you one. Then you have two, and you can give one away. You can go to www.store.str.org, and we'll send one of those to you. We're just really, really excited about this. Okay. Incidentally, if you have read Tactics in the past and you want to get this one, great, I want you to get it because there's so much new material. But you know, if you weighed in on Tactics on Amazon saying how much you love the book, and we have almost a complete, over the last 10 years, complete five-star rating. I think the average is 4.8. Okay, so there's a couple of outliers, but almost everybody gave it five stars. All that goes away on November 26th. We're starting over again. So I'm just going to ask you a favor that you weigh in on the 26th or soon after that with the comments that are genuine regarding your opinion about the Tactics book, even if you don't have the new one yet. The new one is everything the old one had plus a whole bunch more. So if you like the old one and gave it five stars, I guarantee you, you're going to give 5 stars to the new one. But I would like your support. I'd appreciate that whole system building up there, you know, with good reviews, because I think the book deserves it. Anyway, that's just my request if you want to help out. Okay, let's see. I want to briefly speak to something that comes up on a regular basis with me. In fact, I was talking with J. Warner Wallace and Frank Turek about that, and about this particular issue. And it's something actually each of us get, well, each of us hears this on occasion, actually with some regularity in my case. I'd not heard any of the other fellows talk about it before, but this last weekend as we're hanging out together during Rethink in Minneapolis, trying to stay warm in the cold weather there, which, by the way, was like 65 degrees colder than L.A., and Anchorage, Alaska was 17 degrees warmer. So we were a bit out of our ken there, weather-wise, but we're huddling together talking. And the thing that we hear, and I hear frequently, is I would love to be an apologist like you. People will come up to us and say that. I'd like to do what you do. Now, I'm going to tell you what my reaction to that is. And my reaction is that this is a noble desire, and I am completely flattered when people say that. The reason I'm flattered is because it means that individuals who say that to me or to Frank or to Jay Warner are people who are looking up to us and who admire us in some measure and would like to be used the way God has used us in their lives and the lives of others. So it's all good in that regard. It's a very sweet thing for somebody to say to us. But, of course, now we need to give them some advice, because that's what they're asking for. How can I do what you do? And some of you know that I have a kind of a stock response to the comment. I recommend two things. First, I say, bloom where you're planted. And secondly, I say, be a student of your craft. Okay? So let me say something about both of those, because there are some of you that are listening that may have these sentiments. Because there is a little bit of a warning I want to add to this that I don't usually add when people ask me about it, but I think it's appropriate to mention now. First, I say, bloom where you're planted. It's a very basic biblical principle. If you're faithful in small things, well, let me put it backwards. It's not quite a promise, this conditional, if then. It's first be faithful in small things, and then maybe greater things will come. I don't know. I can't promise that. But I know it's the small first and then the big, not the big first. The big first is huge, hugely dangerous. You get the big things right off the bat, and this is going to happen for some people who are celebrities already and become Christians, and all of a sudden they're thrust into the limelight. And in almost every case, this is a terrible combination. Be faithful in the small things. Most of you aren't superstars, so you don't have to worry about that. Be faithful in the small things. And this was the MO that I had. I became a Christian in 1973. Within about a year of becoming a Christian, I was convinced I wanted to spend the rest of my life in full-time ministry. That didn't happen for another 11 years, 10 years after that. I waited another decade before I got into full-time Christian work. And I was working hard. I was doing good stuff. I've been overseas I went to working behind the Iron Curtain. I worked 2 summers over in Hawaii as a summer outreach project. Then the third summer, summer 76, I went behind the Iron Curtain. 5.5 weeks helping Christians who are struggling there. 3.5 months in Europe, all told. And I came back and I attached myself to a local church. I started teaching around the community and in my church, doing what I could, blooming wherever it was that I was planted. But I didn't get into full-time Christian work for a decade. And then it was just a little here, a little there. And then, let's see, I guess I'd been 20 years a Christian almost. Yes, I was, exactly. 20 years a Christian before we started Stand to Reason. So these things don't come quickly. This is why you have to log your time. You have to start small and be faithful in whatever you can do at the time. Okay, so let's bloom where you're planted. Worry about that, not what's down the line. Be faithful now. What can you give? What can you do in the moment? Where can you volunteer? If you're into teaching and being apologetics, then how can you offer your abilities such as they are in this moment to whoever's available? First obvious choice would be your local church. How can you make yourself available to your local church in this kind of way to help out with these kinds of things and the people who have needs in this area? Okay, first thing, bloom where you're planted. Second, be a student of your craft. Now, what's that mean? It means that you got to take your work seriously. It means you've got to learn how to be good at what you do. What is our craft? Well, our craft is principally communicating a particular kind of knowledge. It's communicating a particular kind of knowledge. You see two categories where we need to work on? The knowledge, theology, philosophy, apologetics. These are all tied to each other, okay? If we're defending the faith, we have to know the faith that we're defending. So that's theology and apologetics, but the philosophy, at least in my case, it really helped me to do the defending better and understand the theology more clearly, making distinctions that help. So part of developing my craft, to be a student of my craft, is to develop my theology more, be more precise. And by the way, being on the air, I remember when I first started going on the air, that forced me to be more careful about all kinds of things. Because I could jabber here and there about different things and shoot my mouth off about my opinion about stuff. But when I'm on the air, it's a little different. I got a bigger audience. I'm in a more of a position of authority. I got to make sure that I got my bases covered on what I'm saying. So there's a knowledge component there. Theology, philosophy, apologetics, okay. But there's also the communication component. And how do we communicate? Well, we write and we speak. All right? And those are each crafts. Some of you may not write, but you'll speak. Some may not speak, but you'll write. Okay, whatever you focus in on doing in this arena, learn to do it well. Most people can't do either well. And what I mean is that they are not naturally excellent in these things. Some people have the gift of gab, but that doesn't mean they're an effective communicator. Sometimes there's too much gab, right? Especially in writing, you've got to trim that stuff down. You've got to pare down to the bone. You've got to cut out the garbage, the nonsense, and the weightiness of it all. I mean, the sluggishness of it all, and get crisp and right to the point and clear. That takes time to learn how to do that. Incidentally, given that we are communicating a theology and philosophy and apologetics within the context of a culture, we have to understand something about the culture that we're speaking into. And that's part of the knowledge element there. One other element of the knowledge that I didn't mention is that nowadays it means managing the digital world and social media effectively. These are all parts of the craft. You want to be effective, you want to do the kinds of things that you see others that you look up to doing, then you pay the price that they're paying. You get better over time being committed to your craft. So bloom where you're planted and be a student of your craft. If you give your attention to those things, chances are you will increase in your ability to have an impact. I don't know if your name will ever be on a book. I don't know if your name will ever be on a marquee somewhere. But the goal is to bloom where you're planted, not necessarily be a well-known writer or speaker. It's to be useful in the kingdom where God puts you, where he gives you opportunity. So that's a lot of stuff. And it takes a lot of time. And this is kind of the warning part I'm moving into now. You need a lot of time to develop these skills. And there's something else that time will give you that's vital here, and that is wisdom. And wisdom takes a long time and a lot of experience and making of a lot of mistakes in order to get it. This is something that Frank and Jim and I were knocking around. People do not have an understanding of that component that is part of this whole process. That you're putting your time in grade, you're getting knocked around, you're making mistakes, you're learning, and little by little you get better and better and better at it. Because you're hopefully, by attending properly, getting good feedback, and praying about being fruitful in a productive way, in a way that lasts, you're developing a kind of a deep-seated understanding of how this stuff all works to be a communicator of important knowledge to audiences. You need wisdom to know how to use your knowledge properly. You need wisdom to know how to maneuver with character in the face of opposition. And you need wisdom to know how to be protected from the pitfalls, and there are many of them, when people look up to you in the public square. So all this to say, I think it's a noble desire, and I want to encourage anyone who has this desire, but I want to be square with them. There's a long road of hard work that's ahead for anyone who wants to be really effective in this area. And then when you get in play, being before the public is challenging. It takes patience and sensitivity and a lot of care, because when people look up to you, that is a sacred stewardship. You have a great opportunity to have an impact on people for the good, but you have a great opportunity to have just as big of an impact on those people for the bad if you're not careful. That's why wisdom is so important in this. All right, let's take a break. And when I come back, I got lots of callers to chat with on Stand to Reason.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
What does a silo of soybeans or an old 1987 Nissan truck have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. STR's partnership with iDonate makes donating non-cash items easy. You can give personal items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, gift cards, and more. iDonate takes care of selling the items and gives the cash proceeds to STR. So if you're looking for a unique way to support the work of Stand to Reason, consider donating that random gift card Aunt Bertha gave you last Christmas. Simply go to str.org/donate and click the link at the bottom of the page.
All right, back with you here, Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. Let's get right to the callers. Here we have in Granbury, Texas, Craig. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Fine. Thank you.
Yeah, just kind of doing like you're trying to do is stay warm here. And had a cold front come through yesterday. Woke up, it was 68, and this morning it was 22, and
then
13 with a heat index.
Oh, man, that's like Wisconsin was last week.
Yeah, but it'll be back in the 70s by the weekend. But
that's crazy.
Texas for you. But
yeah.
Anyway, my question for you is actually, I guess, some more guidance/advice.
Okay.
and navigating the waters in a conversation with the transgender agenda.
Mm-hmm.
By trade, I'm a pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
And it, with the passage of the Equality Act, it's only going to be a matter of time before some parent presents me with a prescription for puberty blockers for their son or daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And although legally I have every grounds to stand on to refuse to fill it.
You do have, did you say?
I do.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's nice. In Texas, that's great. Probably in many other states, you wouldn't have a leg to stand on.
At least as of this point. I've got a colleague of mine who's a good friend and also an attorney with a State Board of Pharmacy, and I had him specifically check into it. And as far as if I refused to fill it, it would never see light of day of a courtroom.
Hmm.
Because it's in dispensing the medication, you know, when we took a took an oath, you know, to cause no harm.
Yeah.
That stuff causes harm.
Yes. right. These are puberty blockers, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And,
man.
Yeah. And the other part of the support that I have is when talking with a parent or whoever about them, you know, I don't have to offer my opinion, my preference, or anything. All I need to do is let them read the package insert, and because it tells exactly what happens on there. And it is, as a whole, it's a relatively benign kind of drug. It's one of those that works only as long as you use it. Once you stop using it, then the puberty, you know, just goes on like it had been. But anyway, what my question was is how, when I have a parent that shows up that basically demands that I fill it, how would you, you know, in your charitable and winsome way, have a conversation to decline filling it?
Oh, well, let me ask you another question first. Are you the owner of this business, or do you work for somebody else as a pharmacist?
Yeah, I work for that very large three-letter outfit.
Okay. I wonder what those three letters might be. I'm not going to try to guess. Okay. Same place I got my script yesterday. Anyway, what your question has to do is how do you converse with somebody who wants to get this medication for their child? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And
you don't want to offer moral advice. You want to offer professional advice as a pharmacist. Was that the distinction I heard?
Basically, it is. You know, as you know, when you talk with anyone who's at least made the decision to at least go this far, you know, rational conversation is pretty much out the door.
Yeah.
And I know my employer will just throw me under the bus for refusing the sale, but hey.
He will throw you under the bus, is that right?
But if they push it hard enough, that's probably what would do it because they don't want the publicity.
Okay, sure. Now, what is the opportunity? I have some things I can suggest to say to someone, but I'm thinking about your circumstance. You're a pharmacist, and somebody walks up to the table and asks to pick up this to fulfill this prescription. And what opportunity do you have to have any kind of discussion with them of the nature that you are interested in having?
Well, that's kind of the kicker because it's a very high volume, very fast pace. I generally don't get much more than, I'd say, under best of circumstances, 60 seconds. Now, in that particular situation, when it arrives, you know, I would, you know, definitely take them aside and say, you know, take the train off the tracks. We got some talking to do. And what I'm really wanting to know is, I guess mainly is because my personal attitude behind it is kind of like, you know, if a cop is, you know, at a, you know, pulling, you know, to a bank robbery and the perp has a gun on a hostage, basically my motive is not to treat the perp with kindness, and hope and rationalize with them is to get the victim out of the way.
Right, right. No, I follow that. I just think that this is really a difficult circumstance. First of all, it's not like an abortifacient, which is a life or death kind of circumstance. And you
right.
could say, I'm bowing out and not participate in this. I do think you ought to have the latitude yourself to say, and this is part I didn't quite understand from what you mentioned before, but you should say, you know, morally, I cannot administer this. Somebody else is going to have to do it. But I can't do this because I think it's harmful to your child, and I have an obligation to do no harm, okay? Then you pass them on to somebody else. And so that's how you get yourself out of that. I don't know how, I mean, practically speaking, I don't know how you would get into a conversation with the person. Now, part of what you just told me, that the drug itself is a fairly benign drug. It accomplishes its goal by blocking the development of puberty. Yet, if they stop taking the drug, there's no long-term permanent effects. Is that right?
Potentially. Depends on what kind of dose and how long they take it for and at what age they begin.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, my understanding of these drugs are dangerous. I think taking as a whole because they mess up your whole system at a period of time in the life where the timing is important. You can't put off puberty until you're 20 years old, for example. That just, your body's, I don't know medical aspects of it, but it just seems that your body's, now you're all out of kilter, and it has long-term consequences. So that's something you may know about that I don't, but that's my sense of things.
Yes. I say benign in the sense that, you know, one or two doses, it's not likely to do anything. Yeah, it's going to give your body, you know, a jolt, but...
But they're not getting them for one or two doses. They're getting them for long-term treatment.
No, they're getting them, month after month for ostensibly years on end.
Yeah, okay. The difficulty here is you are moving out of a... I'm just thinking of the circumstances. The difficulty is you're stepping out of a professional role and into a personal role, into the personal life of the individual. It would be almost like if you were... And by the way, I'm sympathizing with your circumstance. I'm not chastising you at all. I'm just trying to identify the difficulty of trying to make a difference in this circumstance. It would be like somebody who puts a package of condoms down there and wants to purchase it, and you said, well, wait a minute, what are you going to use these for? You know, you stepped out of the role of a professional or a merchant, and now you're into a role that many would consider would be an inappropriate intrusion into their lives.
But that I can see, but the large difference between those two scenarios is the one with the puberty blockers. If they're not doing it for themselves, they're trying to do it to somebody else.
Well, if you're... Yeah, that's right, but that somebody else apparently wants, I presume, if they're gender dysphoric, this is what they want. You know, from the parents. Anyway, I agree there's a difference in degree, and there's some differences. It's just the broader issue of stepping out of a professional role and into a private concern of somebody's life. And I don't know how you can affect that shift standing behind the counter wearing your white pharmacy robe. You know, I don't know what that's going to look like. If I were going to try to discourage somebody, the thing I would say, if I only had a very short period of time, I'd say, do you think this is the best way to deal with the gender dysphoria of your child? Because you may not know this, but the attempted suicide rate for gender dysphoric people is 25 times the national rate. 25 times. I want then let's see what they think, because it's a terrible situation to be in. But why encourage this? And by the way, it's the same in Sweden as it is here. So it isn't because all these people are making somebody else feel bad. All these straight Christian types are making people feel bad for being gender dysphoric, you know, or transgendered. It's because there's something going on inside of them that is not good. And they're doing the best they cope with it, but is this the right way to cope with it? Here's the other thing, too, is that many, many young people who are gender dysphoric at the moment adjust and adapt, and this is a stage that goes away after a while, which is possible if you're not taking all these drugs. But once you take a lot of these drugs, or especially if you have like a double mastectomy, you can't change that. There is a thing going around now called rapid onset gender dysphoria, ROGD, and it's because it's become a little bit of a fad, a social contagion, to be gender dysphoric. You're a hero, you know. And so it's being encouraged in the culture. These may be two things that would be helpful to say if you had an opportunity to say them. The first one is the suicide rate, attempt rate is skyrockets. And secondly, that a lot of times left alone or with proper care, this goes away. But if you start messing with them chemically, it's going to be a lot more difficult to recover. Right.
I guess really the first step would really be to establish, you know, is the person coming to me, are they militant or are they kind of uncertain or unsure about what it is they're doing? But, you know, because that's what you hear on Facebook, that this is the thing to do.
Yeah, well, and you only have 50 seconds, you said, so it's going to be hard to. Maybe you could say, could I ask you a personal question? Oh, why is it that you are using this drug for your child? Is this what your child wants, or is this what you want, or is this what their teacher wants? Or just to find out that. And then how do you personally feel about it as a parent? And if they say, well, you know what, this is what my child wants, but I'm uncomfortable, but this is what they want, and everybody's saying it's fine. Then you could say, well, I just want to pass on two pieces of information just so you're apprised. The suicide rates skyrocket in gender dysphoria cases. And secondly, these things resolve themselves with adolescence, often on their own over time. But they can't resolve themselves once you start pumping drugs into them. It's a much more difficult situation.
So, okay.
I don't know. That's the best I could do under the circumstances, Craig.
That's one of those things we can sit here. We could go back and forth for hours, but until the situation actually presents itself, we really won't know how to definitively respond. You know?
Yeah. Well, think of a question to ask first.
Yeah.
A question that will get them to reveal something. And yes, you might apologize. So you say, hey, do you mind if I ask you a personal question? So you get permission. Then you ask this question that might give you a sense of what they're about and their temperament about it. If you sense hostility or anger or dogmatism, there's no sense going any further. They'll complain, and then you lose your job.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're not going to do any good in that situation, and why do harm for yourself?
Well, you better send them across the street to the other guys and let them fill it.
Your three-letter acronym organization is not going to be happy about that either.
No, they won't.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they don't hold my license in my hand. The state board does, so.
Say it again. They can't take it.
I said they don't hold. Right. My employer doesn't hold the license in their hands. The state board
does.
So.
That's right, but they do sign your check.
Yes, they do.
All right.
But.
Maybe in a while, Craig, get back to me in 6 months or something after you've kind of worked this out. If you've stumbled upon something useful or helpful, let me know, because I think others would like to hear about it, too. Okay. Thank you, Craig.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Let's go to break here, and we'll come back to our other callers in just a moment. Greg Kokol, on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Him to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate and choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
All right, back with you here. And by the way, don't forget to download our apps. I almost never say anything about this, but we got some fabulous apps. The standard STR app, we have a quick reference app, and we have, what else we got? I don't use them. I made them. But they're available at str.org. And if you get your standard Reason app, of course, it's all free. It has the solid grounds. It has the most recent podcast. It has the most recent STR asks. It's gives you access to a lot of things. So I just want to recommend those. Let me just see here. Downloader apps. We have all the latest content, ability to stream podcasts. There's the I should be reading my text, right? That might help. The STR quick reference app has short courses on important topics like tactics, the ambassador model, a story of reality. Download them on iTunes today. Okay, there you go. iTunes has the STR apps. Good thing I read that last line. All right, let's go to Joel. Let me find your button here, Joel, in New York City. Hello, Joel.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
All right.
So basically, I'm just wanting to get your thoughts on, I don't know, like formal argument or anything, but just something I was thinking about when trying to maybe argue why there's a theistic God versus a deistic God.
Say it again. It sounded like you said the same thing. A theistic versus a deistic? Is that what
yes.
you said? Okay.
Because I think, at least from my obviously view, the evidence is clear that there's something outside of our universe that had to create this universe.
Right.
And so that points to, you know, a powerful being such as a God.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes maybe moving from a deistic God to a theistic God might be a little bit more difficult. And so I was just kind of thinking that the fact that we are personal points to the fact that there has to also be a personal God, because for us to have personhood or personality, like that wouldn't come from something that doesn't have that. What do you think about that?
Well, a couple of thoughts here. First of all, J. Warner Wallace argues that way in his book, God's Crime Scene, and he looks at human consciousness, and the best explanation for the existence of human consciousness is a divine consciousness that produces human consciousness. So there is a point to be made there. However, you're asking, just clarification, are you asking for yourself? Like, are you kind of a deist and not sure about being a theist, or are you just...
No, I'm a Christian, and I believe in a theistic God. I just obviously like to think about these things.
Okay, sure. Good. Okay, just for my own understanding. Both a theistic God and a deistic God are personal. The difference between the two is not their personality, but their involvement with the rest of creation subsequent to creation. Okay, so, deism is a personal God who creates a clockwork universe. He winds it up and he lets it go. That's deism. So a theistic God is a personal God who makes the universe but then stays involved in some sense. He's transcendent, but he's also immanent. He's present here and involved. So strictly speaking, a deistic God, with a deistic universe, you will not have miracles. You will not have scripture, God communicate. You won't have any intervention of God. And whatever those happen to be, like miracles or giving scripture or answering prayer, those things aren't going to happen. Not on a deistic view of God. So I think if somebody is trying to decide between the two views, the fact that the universe is here, any arguments for a creator and designer, so you've got the design argument and the cosmological argument and the teleological design argument, and even a God who is moral, who makes moral creatures like human beings, it seems to me all of those could be characteristic of a deistic God. You need more to show that God is involved in his universe and he's not afar off. And what you need there is you need evidence of his involvement. Now, that might be miracles that are best explained by God intervening, some supernatural act that takes place that seems to be evidence of God intervening, that could be answered prayer that is evidence of God intervening, and it could be God intervening by becoming a human being himself and walking the planet, like in the person of Jesus. So those are the three areas that I think would be evidential to make the case for a theistic God as opposed to a mere deistic God.
Okay, so Jesus would probably be maybe the best in terms of, because I think the other two might be a little bit more difficult, especially prayer, because that could be considered like subjective. But
well,
it's
not subjective if you're praying a precise prayer and the prayer gets answered as a matter of historical fact. As long as the prayer is specified and there's some specified complexity, then if you say, God, take care of my needs, well, okay, well, maybe your needs are going to be taken care of even if you don't say that general prayer. But if you say, God, I need a $575 check by tomorrow morning, and one shows up on your doorstep for that amount of money by tomorrow morning, that is much more specified complexity. That seems to be the evidence of a designer or a personal God involved. So depending on the kind of prayer you're praying, you may have good grounds to believe that God has intervened because the prayer has been answered, especially in prayers that it's highly unlikely they're going to happen on their own or by accident.
So Sorry.
I was just going to say, so prayer could be, even though it's subjective in the sense that it's a subject that's doing it, it still has an objective quality to it that can be assessed objectively.
For you, which of the three would you consider the strongest? Would it be Jesus or would it be?
Well, I think that the one that's most immediately accessible is going to be Jesus, because there's a body of information already available. You can't conjure up a miracle for somebody who wants to see whether God's personally involved in the planet or not, because that
right.
God decides that. So that would be the least, I think, the least profitable direction to go. The most would be dealing with Jesus, and the middle one would be answered prayer. And it's going to have force if your prayers are clearly specified and are complex. Now, in other words, it's not the kind of thing that would just happen without God's intervention.
Right. Is that, and I kind of actually heard Francis Schaeffer, I was listening to something of his, talk about this idea. Just the idea that anything that we have, God must also have, just because the example he used, and maybe you heard this before, was the idea of two valleys. And if there's water in both valleys, you'd be justified in saying the valley that has the lower level water may have gotten
right.
Water.
That's the illustration that he uses. I'm familiar with that. I'm not sure. I think that may work in some things. There seems to be a common sensibility about the idea that you get personality from personality. You get consciousness from consciousness. You get one level of morality from a source of morality. So I think that there's some value there. But remember, what we're not talking about that when you're talking about the distinction between a theistic God and a deistic God.
Right, yeah, which I understand that now, and I didn't get that, I think, before. But I was just curious if that other point was still valid, just the idea of, like, the water flowing down, you know, anything that we have, you know, something that created us would also have to have at least.
Sure. Well, keep in mind that that is an illustration, and illustrations make your points more clear, but they don't make your point. So the fact that you can illustrate the point doesn't mean that it's evidence for the point. It's like somebody says, well, there are many ways to God. Oh, what do you mean? Well, you go to the top of the mountain and there are many roads to get to the top of the mountain. Well, that's not an argument for pluralism. That is just an illustration of pluralism. And by the same token, the water flowing from the higher level to the lower level is an illustration, but it is an argument for it. And so I think you'd have to do more than just make that use the illustration to solidify or justify your point.
Just real quick, in line with the deist and theist God that you're saying, they're both personal. Wouldn't that also demand, especially if that being is eternal, which I don't think anybody would argue with that if they accept that there's a deist or theist God?
Yeah, I think they could both be eternal, right? If they manifest the perfections, ontological perfections, then they would be eternal. They're not contingent. They didn't come into being.
Well, what I was going to ask is, if they're eternal, wouldn't that the only way they could be personal and eternal would be if there's more than one of them, and that, like, basically pointing towards the Trinity, essentially, or, you know, it could be, I guess, a double God, but it would have to be more than one in order for them to be personal in eternity.
Why would that be? I'm not sure I'm following the logic of that. Because a personal being has to interact with
to be a person with, yeah.
Well, I don't. It doesn't seem to me that if God can only be personal if there's another person to interact with. It just means that his personal qualities, which is that he's a self-conscious individual. That's what I think about personal. It doesn't mean that God is interpersonal necessarily.
All right, that makes sense.
Makes sense. So, I mean, it could be just that he's just a self that is aware and he's by himself, and then maybe make something for his pleasure to enjoy or to share himself with in some way, but I don't think that's a necessity of being a personal God, which simply means that in the way we're using the word personal, that there's a conscious self there.
The theistic God would have to be interpersonal, though, right? If he's interacting with us? Maybe not the deistic
I'm just,
God.
I'm
but...
just, I mean, I'm wondering, could a theistic God create a universe in which there are no personal beings, but he still interacts in the universe? He doesn't just wind it up and let it go. He might still be doing stuff. I guess in principle he could, but it seems like the point of having a theistic God is that he is a God that is personal, who is interacting with his creation on a personal level, because that would be the only thing that's meaningful, you know? He wouldn't be just moving the natural chess pieces around the board for the fun of it or whatever. It seems like his interaction... I've never thought about this issue before, so I'm trying to work through the details. You have two different types of causes. One is an event cause, where one domino hits another domino, and the reason the first domino hit the second is because there was a domino before it that hit it. So you got all this mechanistic motion going on. That's the clockwork universe. Now, the other kind of causation is an agent, which is able to initiate by an act of the will a causal sequence. Certainly God would be an agent there who creates the universe that then begins to be complicated dominoes falling, but another individual who is an agent in that universe can also initiate causal sequences. So the point of being theistic and interacting personally would be that there are personal agents that one could interact with. Because if there's no agents, then it's just a machine, and there is no personalized interaction, even though God could be personal in that circumstances. So I think the upshot then is that it makes sense that a theistic God who interacts in his creation would create other agents to interact with him in a meaningful way. And then part of that interaction, he's communicating to them. So that's revelation. He is interacting in their lives. That's a miracle. He is responding to their requests. That would be prayer. And if necessary, he would come down and be with them in order to rescue them from a dangerous circumstance that they're in.
Awesome. All right. Yeah, lots to think about there.
Yeah. I've not really thought these things through quite like that before, but you never know. You get a good caller and raises a good question, and then you say, well, let me think about that for a moment. You never know what you're going to come up with. Anyway, I hope that's helpful.
Yes, it was. Thank you so much, Greg.
Okay, I appreciate your call, Joel.
Have a great night.
Yeah, you too. Take care. Never thought about that, but I guess you could be personal, not have any persons to interact with, but that would be kind of dull. And one of the things that many people have pointed out with regards to the personal God of the Bible is that this God is not just personal. That is, he is a person, a self-conscious being, but also that he is interpersonal in himself. He is ontologically in his nature. At the base of his being, he is an interpersonal God because of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And in some ineffable, unique, magnificent, unfathomable way are interacting with each other and loving each other and being interpersonal with each other for all of eternity. Pretty cool. Anyway, all right. Good note to end on, the ineffable character of God. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. Give him heaven. Bye-bye now.